Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 25th, 2024. We are in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:03 p.m. Today we have present Representative McKay, Representative Vance, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair McCabe. The staff assisting us today are Recording Secretary Linda Jensen, Moderator Susan Quigley, and Angela Steffel, my committee aide. Thank you for your service today, ladies. If everyone could please silence their cell phones, that would be great. Then you don't have to bring me donuts the next time. We have two items of business today. First, we will hear from Mr. Randy Ruaro, the ADA Executive Director, with a presentation on financing infrastructure in Alaska. Following that presentation under bills previously heard and scheduled, we will hear the introduction to HB 233, an act relating to rates and time allowances for motor vehicle warranty work. So first up, we'll have ADA, Alaska Industrial Development Export. What's the E?
Export.
Export Agency. Mr. Randy Ruaro, who is the executive director. He is here in person. And online available for teams that kind of wimped out and didn't come to Juneau. We have Brandon Brzezinski, ADA Deputy Director, Jeff Johns, ADA Chief Investment Officer, and Mark Davis, ADA Counsel. So, Mr. Raro, if you'd like to place your name on the record and begin your presentation, and do you want to wait till we get done to ask questions or just do it on a slide-by-slide?
Either way is fine, Chair.
All right. Well, we'll let them build up for a bit, and then if there's questions, we'll just kind of navigate back and forth. So, and all the auto dealers in the audience are waiting with just huge excitement to hear your presentation.
All right. For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O. I'm the executive director for ADA, and if I'm operating the slides, Mr. Chair, I might need a quick update on how to advance them. Oh, right there. Okay, great. All right. So I thought I'd start, before we get into our financing tools, Mr. Chair, just talking a little bit about ADA's statutory mission, which is provided by the legislature in Title 44, Chapter 88. And our purpose is set out as very simple. It's to create jobs and economic development. But there was also a finding made by the legislature, and I think this goes back as far as 1967, where the legislature found that unemployment was a particularly serious menace, and I'm quoting from the statute, serious menace to the health, safety, and general welfare of the people in areas of high unemployment, but also to the people of the entire state. And even though the data wasn't clear at the time, maybe, that they entered this finding into the statutes. We now have a lot of data. One of those studies I provided to the committee, it's a study related to suicide and difficulties in rural Alaska. And that study found that isolation, a lack of access to jobs and education, and a lack of basic socioeconomic ability to earn a living and advance was a contributor to high suicide rates. Our suicide rate for Alaska Native men is 14 times the national average at, 141.6 per 100,000 persons, and that is 14 times the national average. It's a serious problem. And I think we'd also find, and I'll pursue some more information on this front, what the benefits are of jobs and economic development in rural areas such as Red Dog, Northwest Arctic Borough. I'm going to look into that. And I think what I'm going to find is that those rates are much reduced when persons are gainfully employed, earning a good living. And those salaries at Red Dog are well over $100,000 a year, I think, to start. And so, you know, when we're working at ADA, we're not only reviewing projects for financial benefits and return to ADA, but we're also reviewing them with a thought towards the persons in Alaska that will benefit from those jobs. And that's just as important as financial return, in my opinion.
Thanks. Representative Vance has a question.
Thank you. For clarification, what was the year of this legislative finding?
I believe the legislative finding was made in 1967.
Through the chair, for clarification, and that was that when the suicide statistics came, or is that the more recent finding?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the 1967 finding and statute was well before the study, which is a 2022 study. I was just trying to point out that their concerns, you know, are proving out that jobs and economic development, basically hope for a better future, is important, you know, all over Alaska.
Thank you for that clarification. Now I have the connection.
Sure.
That would actually be really a good op-ed if you do look into that to find out the difference in suicide rates from an economically developed area like around Red Dog versus, you know, especially we have some fishing communities right now where fishing is real depressed, and kind of compare that. And I mean, it's going to prove, I'm sure, what we all already know, is that people are much happier when they're gainfully employed and they are, you know, able to support themselves and their families. And so, anyways, looking forward to the next must-read article from Randy.
We will dive into that because it is important. And just one last thought before moving into the main part of the presentation. There's also been studies performed that show how important a good job is to a rural subsistence lifestyle in terms of being able to afford that lifestyle. I think gasoline in Noatak is $17 a gallon now. So, you know, a steak is probably $40, you know. So we think economic development and jobs are important all over the state, but particularly in rural Alaska. So having said that, Chair, we'll move into the presentation. Our mission, as I mentioned, is really simple. It's jobs and economic development. The revenue we generate is allocated to the dividend, which comes back to the general fund, and reinvestment in ADA's programs and projects. And we do have right now, Mr. Chair, without getting into a lot of the details, we do have several hundred million dollars in our project pipeline right now, and hope to have some pretty exciting announcements coming here soon of projects that we'll be advancing in the state.
As long as those exciting announcements include the words Alaska Railroad, I will be very happy.
All right. Our projects must meet two criteria, be a sustainable financial investment, and create tangible benefits for Alaskans, jobs and economic development. And when we look at sustainable financial investment, we do have a number of regulations on the books that require us to do financial planning, due diligence reviews, which we do engage in. And in fact, since I've come on board, we've stepped that up and added a number of types of reviews and additional things to look into that are not in regulation, but are policy at ADA to follow up on. So this is our specific public interest. We act in the public interest. We've got very broad powers. The legislature realized that ADA needed flexibility to enter into agreements. For instance, we can finance federal infrastructure improvements, such as the Coast Guard base at J-Bear. We do need some language on the federal side in their budgets that gives the federal agencies authority to accept non-federal funds. But we work with the congressional delegation when we see an opportunity and try to get that in their budget. So we'll continue doing that just so we have that tool available. We also have powers to issue bonds. We can invest as an equity investor. We have a long list, frankly, almost 24 sections long, I think, of different tools that the legislature's given us over the years. And those are, you know, having that broad authority to act is critical. As you can imagine, if everything that we did was subject to a legislative review, then we probably wouldn't get much business. So we've been given broad authority, and we try to be very responsible with that. Here's our financial toolbox, and I'm actually going to let Brandon walk through these different sections here.
So, Mr. Brzezinski, you can hear us, right?
Yep, I can hear you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, Deputy Director, ADA, and with me here, I also have Jeff Johns, our Chief Investment Officer. So, as Mr. Raro stated, so this is a preview of what ADA has in terms of its financial capabilities. Just starting at the top left there, not so much as far as transportation goes, but just generally economic development. ADA's loan participation program, it's about a $400 million loan portfolio, and it facilitates a lot of commercial small business transactions in this state, and is critical for keeping cash flow in our banking system. Moving over, we have just ADA's project finance. This is like where we act more like a bank and do direct commercial loans. So an example would have been our loan to Hex that we made several years ago. We have conduit revenue bonds. Well, we can issue conduit revenue bonds. That's where we're just the facilitator of issuing the bonds on behalf of like a nonprofit, for instance. We've done this for like the TCC Hospital and the Bethel Hospital. Moving on to energy resource development. So, I mean, we have other tools that are aimed at financing energy-type projects, resource development projects in the Arctic. So we have the SETS Fund, the Sustainable Energy Transmission Supply Fund. The big example for that would be the IGU up in Fairbanks. And given that they're trucking the gas, I guess there is an element of transportation associated with that. And then there's the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund. That focuses on a region that is defined in statute. It does include Dutch Harbor, but it kind of swoops up around, and then it's obviously the Arctic. We have some additional financing capabilities through that fund. Ambler would be looked at to use for that fund. ADA can own assets. So, for example, we own the Ketchikan Shipyard. We own the FedEx hangar out at the airport, the big one that you can drive a 777 inside. They really appreciated that this winter. We can also do ADA bonds generally off of our balance sheet. We can do tax exempt, we can do taxable, et cetera. And then also, we want to be like a clearinghouse for just economic development, generally speaking. We have a lot of strong relationships with our sister agencies, with the state, federal agencies, local development authorities. And if ADA can't be the one to finance something for you, if it doesn't fit our portfolio, chances are we know where to send you. So, and we are more than happy to play matchmaker. Next slide.
So, Mr. Brzezinski, Representative Stutz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I do have a question. I was interested to hear you say that you own the Ketchikan Shipyard. What would the rate of return be on the Ketchikan Shipyard?
Through the chair, the rate of return on the Ketchikan Shipyard is not high.
Like zero or less?
It's not zero, but it's not much larger than probably 1-2%. It's not a lot. And so we're working with the shipyard, and we're working with some other entities to try to find a way, frankly, to focus on recapitalizing the fleet in Alaska. We're going to try to see if there's a way to have the shipyard specialize almost in new fishing vessels. We've got a lot of vessels that are aging out. And so I'll be meeting with the shipyard here probably in the next 60 days to talk about, is there a way to supplement the ferry business, which they do mostly maintenance and construction of ferries? Is there a way to plug in a way to start recapitalizing, rebuilding our fishing fleet in Ketchikan? And that's a large, I think it's 90 plus vessels, that we could possibly get into a stream. But we really want to increase the return and increase the business and grow jobs at the same time. So we're focused on trying to find a way to make that yard bigger and better.
Follow it.
Thank you. It's my understanding that pretty much the only customer they have are the state ferries currently, and that they're operated by the shipyard that exists in Seward. So I'm curious as to why we don't get rid of it.
Sell
it.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, ways to either improve the yard. If we can't improve the yard and the rate of return, then selling it or seeing if there's a different operator that would want to come in that can possibly do more. Those are options that are always on the table, I believe, under the operating agreement, you know, for the board to consider. We're doing an internal review of how the shipyard operates, and do we have other opportunities, for example, with the fishing sector to enter into some agreements to rebuild that fleet and supplement the ferry revenue. But, you know, it's all kind of under a significant internal review right now.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I understand it's been a multitude of years that it's been a loss to the state. And so I'm glad to see that it's being addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was Representative Stutes through the chair. I know I heard her say that.
Yes,
Mr. Ferraro, I'm curious. When you talk about 1-2%, okay, that's your direct return. But what about the economic benefits of having the shipyard there? So do you track the indirect jobs, transportation jobs, bringing goods and supplies into the shipyard and all of that sort of stuff? Is that something ADA tracks right now, or is that I'd be curious to know that as well.
Through the chair, we estimate between 80 and 120 jobs on average throughout a year. Those are largely trades, craftsmen jobs, welders, pipe fitters, everything it takes to work on a boat, painters, so laborers. So those are all jobs that are provided by the shipyard, and those are important. And then there's any materials the yard needs, right, that are bought locally, you know, that also contributes to the economy in an indirect benefit.
Thanks. The idea with the fishing boats, is that something that the community is asking for? Is that something you're shopping out there? And would that help increase the jobs and the churn, economic churn, if you will?
Sure. Through the chair, I believe the community leaders support, you know, getting more business, obviously, through the yard. And I'll be, like as I say, I'll be down there in about, 30 to 60 days meeting with them as well. But the goal is really try to improve the yard, as Rep. Stutes mentioned, and just get us. I think what's really needed is a steady flow of work, right, that they can count on to be consistent, and then they can order their materials. It's not kind of a start and stop, you know, constant effort as one boat leaves the yard and it may be 2 months before the next boat comes in. We want to have a base level of consistent flow through the yard.
Thanks. Okay, on we go.
All right, Mr. Chair, before we leave this slide, I just wanted to mention a couple other tools that are in our toolbox. And one is that ADA qualified with the Federal Department of Energy as a state energy financing institution, a SEFI, which means that we have certain abilities to finance renewable energy projects under federal law at a very positive match rate that could be as high as 95-5 through their loans and loan guarantee program. And so that's a new available designation and new authority. So I think ADA is one of only 13 entities in the nation that went forward and applied and got that designation. So we'll be looking to use that as a tool as well. And then we do have, in addition to these programs, we have a small business program that's run through the Division of Investments, and we're looking to improve that program, stand it up even further. Those loans are usually maximum at $300,000, so these are small mom-and-pop, you know, type businesses, and we're going to try to improve that program as well.
Nice. So Since we are still on this slide, we in this committee passed an amendment the other day giving Ada some bonding authority. I've had a number of questions about that, and I just maybe you can describe that. One of the best ways, I think, and I don't know who said this, but somebody said it's just an empty vessel. And I hesitate to use the framework because we use framework all the time here, but we didn't just give you $300 million or whatever it was. So maybe you can expound on that
just
a little bit.
I can do that, Chair. So one of the federal programs that's active right now is credits and loan opportunities for projects that involve rare earth minerals, critical minerals. And so ADA, as a SEFI, as a state energy financing institution, can take advantage of those federal funds at a very very high match rate for the feds of 90 to 95 to 5 ADA dollars, being able to leverage those funds. There's a time limit on that program, I think, of 2027. It expires. And so we sought some bonding authority to be ready if we have to move quickly, if there's a critical minerals related project that comes to us and says they need some financing, and we can then go to the federal government and say we'd like to participate in the SEFI program at 90 to 10, 95 to 5, then we'll be able to then, if we have to go bond for the 5 or 10 that matches, we'll be in a position to do that. So it's really, you're correct, it's not cash. It's not available to us without a project and without going through all of our due diligence and our other hoops. But it may allow us, the fact that it's available in general might allow us to meet the deadlines on these critical mineral and other federal funds for projects. So it's a valuable tool, we think, for us to have. And you know, Alaska's probably got more rare earths than any other state in the nation. And rare earths are a very key element for defense. I think there's 3,400 different weapon systems in the U.S. military that use some type of rare earth or critical minerals. There's several hundred pounds in every F-35. And China has recently taken a step and threatened to limit exports of rare earths to any country that it deems adversarial. And so that would mean, if they deem the United States adversarial, that would mean an immediate loss of supply of germanium, cobalt, you know, a number of other critical minerals. So we would need to step up domestic production very quickly.
Thank you. So, we should probably move on because we have a number of slides to get through. So,
this is the development project finance page. And again, I'll let Brandon or Mr. Johns walk through these.
Okay, for the record, Brandon Brzezinski. We kind of hit on a lot of this. This is just a providing you a list of the types of projects around the state that ADA has either financed or acquired in the past. So we can, for the sake of time, Mr. Chairman, we can go to the next slide. And I guess next slide then. Or no, next slide, best fit projects. Okay, I'm going to take this one over to Mr. Johns.
For the record, my name is Jeffrey Johns, ADA Chief Investment Officer. What we have here is a simple graphic of the evolution of a basic investment or project that would fit under ADA's defined projects under 4488-900 as a best fit project, as defined as a simple plant or facility. And as you can see on the right-hand side of this graphic and slide is ultimately where ADA's best fit would be, as identified in the slide topic. And what we are looking for in terms of our underwriting and potential investment opportunity, be it equity or debt or something similar. And ultimately, we're looking for project proponents, operating experience, the equity contribution. Typically, we would fund at about 75% debt-equity ratio. We're looking at, does the project proponent have the ability to move forward with regards to permitting, purchase and sale agreements? As ultimately, our underlying collateral package would be financed through a revenue stream in order to be able to service, in this particular example, Ada's debt. So any questions on this particular slide?
Nope, we're good to go.
Okay, next slide, please. So again, Ada Project Finance, carrying on from the last slide, is for our specific direct finance program. That is defined in statute, as you can see here, under 4488-172. And as highlighted by Deputy Director Brzezinski, our investment can take many different forms, loans, equity, bonds. We can acquire assets. We can own, etc. And as we highlighted earlier on, is 4488-800 under the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund, as Deputy Director spoke to already, we have a special designated zone as defined in statute, and as Deputy Director Brzezinski highlighted, if successful, the Ambler Access Project would qualify under this particular fund. And then lastly, as I already spoke to, is 4488-900 defines what a project would qualify under the Economic Development Finance Program, a plant or facility. And generally speaking, it is quite a broad definition that allows us to make investments in a very sweet or very broad suite and large scope of what, again, it is we're allowed to, with the exception in tourism to finance hotels. We are not permitted to do so.
Thank you. And so, Mr. Johns, I'm interested at this point to talk about the railroad. Go figure. So where would the railroad fit in one of these? I mean, I suppose if we ran the railroad all the way up to the slope, it would fit in the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund, although that seems a little small of a loan guarantee for what it would cost to do that. But say we wanted to fund $200 million for Port McKenzie rail extension. How would we do that inside of one of these project finance accounts?
It at least under Ada's ability, I think that as Executive Director Raro spoke to, is that with enhanced bonding capacity, it could largely fit under a project revenue type of bond if it was this backstopped by a fairly strong and understood revenue stream. I think ultimately a project of that size would be more suitable to bonds, or at least being one portion of a capital stack. Ultimately, you know, in concert with the railroad, there could be a potential equity component, and of course, Ada's ability to provide risk-based project financing. So,
and Mr. Chairman, this is for the record, Brandon Brzezinski, Deputy Director, and I just add on to the conversation you guys just had about a few minutes ago, you know, that bonding authority that your committee provided us, the $300 million for infrastructure that supports the development of critical mineral projects, arguably you could say that some of that could be used to enhance Port McKenzie or the railway, leading to, if that port were to service critical mineral type projects and activities.
Yeah, so that would be my next question, is how could we fit the railroad under that CEFI 95-5, especially if they were hauling stibnite or antimony to Port McKenzie from, say, Fairbanks or from West Assistant Access or something like that. That's the critical mineral that we're all frankly talking about for the most part, right?
To the chair, that's correct. That I believe it would fit under Title 17 programs and a CEFI use, but it's also important, I think, to remember that Senator Stevens obtained a federal IRS code tax exemption for the Alaska Railroad to be able to bond virtually any type of resource development project tax exempt. And he put that in there, I think, for that very reason, that the railroad, he viewed, could be a major driver of resource development of any type. It doesn't even have to be tied to the railroad. So in 2005, former Oil and Gas Committee Chair Coring, I think, introduced a bill that eventually passed that gave the railroad bonding authority for the gas pipeline, even though there was no railroad track associated with that project. It's a tax-exempt authority. It's on the books. It's rarely, I think, been used by the railroad, but it is federal law. I think that might be the most financially advantageous vehicle for funding not only track improvement, but any type of resource development project. And I can, if you'd like, I can follow up with a citation to the federal statute. And
that would be awesome.
Some of the history.
Representative Sumner.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just interested in some follow-up on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Anybody else? All right, thanks. Moving on, whoever wants to do this next slide.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Brandon Brzezinski for the record. Mr. Mark Davis is online and can speak to the next couple slides, please.
Okay, Mr. Davis, can you hear us?
Yes, you can. For the record, my name is Mark Davis, and I'm counsel to ADA. So if we're looking at page 9, our bonding authority, essentially ADA has the ability by statute to issue its own bonds. Those bonds are backed either by ADA, not the state, they're not state bonds, or they can be issued as revenue bonds. And revenue bonds are bonds that are backed by the revenues of the project. Either way, when a bond is sold, it's purchased by the private sector. That is, bondholders, private individuals, or companies buy those bonds. And so what you're doing by bonds is using the private sector to finance projects for the state. And we have some limitations we've got there. We can only issue up to $25 million without legislative approval. And we have a rolling cap of $400 million in a 12-month period. That is, we can't go beyond that. And I have to have a maturity date of 40 years, but 40 years is longer than most bonds are issued today. And also it's important is these are not the debt of the state under 44881.20. The state is not affected by any bonds that ADA issues, nor is there a pledge of the state. So that means that when ADA issues bonds, like we did, for example, the KY Hospital in Bethel, we were able to work with the private sector with several banks and provide a bridge loan by bonding to get that facility built. And then the rest was taken out by federal government loans by the feds. So without that ability, the hospital would have had to try to raise private capital or come to the legislature. So what ADA does with its bonds is we can step in and provide gap capital to projects and provide a way to tap into the private sector by bondholders buying bonds rather than going through public processes. And bonding has been used for the Long Mountain Transportation System. On the next slide, number 10, is a picture of that.
Okay, Senator Stevens has a question, Mr. Davis. Sure.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Davis. I see it says ADA can issue bonds up to $25 million without legislative approval. Is that amount affected by the $300 million authority that we have given ADA? Does that allow ADA to issue bonds in excess of $25 million without legislative authority?
Excuse to the chair, it would for that particular purpose, which is for minerals, but not for other purposes.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're on number 10.
So on the DMTS, you'll see that was done with bonds, so the private sector invested in that road, and then we built that road for the mine. The mine's used it. We're still got a return on that road, and that's the kind of large project that we can do with bonds. It's also the kind of project that you could do. You mentioned railroad. Railroad is expensive, but so is that port up in the Arctic. So bonds to me is for very large projects. And again, you're not putting the state at risk. You're not putting the state revenue rate at risk, and you're actually using the private sector. So that would be my basic presentation on that. If anybody wants to know more about the DMTS, we can do that. Essentially, it's a very successful project that has generated lots of revenues and jobs. And we do track the jobs, and we know that most of the jobs are from local residents.
Thanks. Moving on to the next slide. We're all about highlighting Ada's successes instead of all the sort of the boondoggles we have managed to find.
Yeah. Chairman, the next slide, slide 12, talks about highlights probably our most successful project, which is Red Dog Transportation System. This is a project that was legislatively approved, I think, in 1985 through a bill. Legislators that year did look at the investment needed to get Red Dog up and running, which was over $500 million total. They chose to authorize and direct ADA to fund up to about a third of that for a road and a port, which we did. And if I could digress just for a minute, it's important to understand that at the time, Cameco was, now Teck, Cameco was looking at record low metal prices. They were having to sell assets, and their largest shareholder, the Canadian Railroad, had sold out of its stock in Cameco. So Cameco was hurting, you know, financially at the time. Legislators looked at the situation and voted, I think, 55-5 in the end, that this investment was needed to be made and should run through ADA, and it was needed in order to get Red Dog up and running. There's been some commentary that ADA's investment wasn't needed, and I just like to put on the record that it absolutely was needed, and that Red Dog, I don't believe, would have made it without ADA. The mine operated for about almost a decade, operated in the red. It was I think it had lost $200 to $300 million by 97, 96. And the plan to save the mine at that time was to expand the mine, get more production out of the mine. And again, they needed ADA and a contribution of funds from ADA to do that expansion. So we claim ADA we claim Red Dog as an ADA success project. Some of the statistics, you know, the mine has benefited everyone from individuals with jobs at Red Dog to the Northwest Arctic Borough PILT payment in lieu of taxes, which is probably close to $300 million now. Those funds go to support schools. They go to support local village improvement projects. And then there's ANCSA 7I payments, again, through just 2021 of over $1.6 billion. And so those 7I payments are then spread out through every Alaska Native ANCSA shareholder throughout the state. And I can say just for my own family that a dividend check through Sea Alaska recently included, I think, $17 a share from 7I payments through Red Dog. And I think it was $4 to $5 a share through other operations. So Red Dog, benefits of Red Dog are statewide and very significant. And then we have tax revenue, you know, through to the state, estimated $1.3 billion. That's a larger number now. So I think these statistics just show the value of that ADA can have with a project. And anyone who's not been to Red Dog, it's a tremendous mine. And if you get a chance to visit it, it's very... very focused on local hire. I think their shareholder hire rate is over 60%. So they're putting a lot of locals to work there. It's a wonderful project. The FedEx aircraft hangar, again, it's another success. We, you know, view it as a significant success by ADA. We're anchoring down FedEx at the airport. They're now expanding with another project. And, of course, the airport's a major driver of jobs and economic development in the Anchorage area. Ketchikan Shipyard, we talked about. This is on our list for review and improvement, and we'll be doing everything we can to increase the amount of work going through there. They have built these fish processing vessels before, I think one for John Winther out of Petersburg, but they've never got into the consistent building of those vessels fleet-wide. They can do it. That vessel turned out very well. But we need some larger customers with a significant number of boats to put through the yard. So that's one that we're working hard on. West Susitna Access, I'll let Brandon talk about this one.
Yeah, for the record, Brandon Bershinsky, Deputy Director, ADA. So forward-looking, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to highlight one of our big projects we have and one of interest to yourself. The West Susitna Access Project, it's a 100-mile road going out west from Big Lake off of Ayrshire Road. Initially, it started under DNR, or DOT, DNR, back in the 2010s, I want to say 2013, 14. Since then, it was somewhat dormant until 2022-21, when ADA received an appropriation from the state to begin the redevelopment of the permitting work needed to actually make this project a reality. So since then, ADA's been working at that. And then up until recently, ADA had the entire project, but now it's been split up into two separate projects where you can see in the slide there, the two red arrows, that would be DOT's project. And they've included this in the STIP, and their plan would be to go about 23, 24-ish miles to get across the Big Sioux and then get across to Alexander Creek from there. So ADA has revised its project, and we are still moving forward with constructing a road, a 24-foot wide gravel road, similar to whatever the DOT design specs are. It wouldn't make sense for us to deviate from that. So, and we're actively moving, and if you go to the next slide there, why is the West Sioux project important? You might hear some folks say, well, this is like a road to nowhere, but that's not true at all. This is a road to a tremendous amount of resources and land and recreational activities for Alaskans. You can talk about food security if folks have access to the fish and wildlife and agriculture land. Timber and emergency management for preventing wildfires. If you have access back there, you can get in there. There's talk about some oil and gas as Cook Inlet's looking for new supply of gas. I know DNR has put out some exploration licenses, solicitations in the region. So if you have a road going in there, it might be more feasible. And then finally, last slide here on page 17, just to give you a current update. So while DOT is moving ahead with their process for their project, this summer, so ADA, what we're doing, we're having a full field season planned. And a lot of the data for the permit has already been gathered, but what we're doing now is going back and we're analyzing alternative routes, things of that nature. So that way when we go and submit for our application, our 404 application with the Corps, ADA is confident that we will have a robust set of information that should help the Corps make an expeditious decision. So with that.
Thanks. Mr. Brzezinski, so I'm pretty sure I heard you say a 32-foot wide road, right? Correct?
Mr. Chairman, I said a 24-foot wide road with 32-foot wide bridges. And if I to note though, that road, the alignment of our road, though, is designed in a way that if the road were to be improved in the future and expanded and widened, the alignment is the alignment you would need for things of that nature. So,
Mr. Raro.
Mr. Chair, one other project to add that's right in the vicinity of the proposed road is the Alaska Renewables very large onshore wind project, which is at Little Mount Susitna. So the road is also a utility corridor. So if that project is built, it would serve renewable energy into the grid as well.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. My apologies if the chairman already asked this. I'm not as familiar with this, the map. Where would the Port McKenzie rail fall on this map if it were to be adopted?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, Port McKenzie's off the map, but it would be in the far right-hand corner. We'd have to expand the map to show where the rail is, but it's not too far off of that corner.
Okay.
I can get you a map that shows all of it.
through the chair, I'm just trying to connect the two in my mind because there's so many resources, whether that's, you know, recreational, fishing, hunting, you know, the minerals, things like that, and just trying to connect the relationship between the road and a rail and how those two could partner for more development. There's just so much potential here on for so many levels. I haven't seen a map with both of them, at least in a while, because of the interest of this committee to try to partner and just bring everything all together. So that's why I asked, is looking at all the ways that we can be supportive and really expand industry.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I do have that map at my office, and I can get the committee a copy.
Yeah, that'd be great. If the DOT is still talking about going out in the Ayrshire Road area, somewhere in there, it comes into the Point McKenzie Road, and then that goes down to the port, probably 10-ish miles from Ayrshire, so maybe a little bit more, maybe 12, down there past Nugent's Ranch and all that, past the Goose Creek Correctional.
Yeah, so through the chair, I think it's a little more than 10, but we can get to that.
Yeah, be, yeah.
Follow up. And I apologize. We had you come in to talk specifically about this project last session, I believe. Did you, for work on this specific project, has there been conversation about the development of partnering the two and how the investment of the road and the rail would work together?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we have looked at those ways to partner together, and we are in discussions with the railroad. We have met with them, and we'll continue to meet and make sure whatever we do works well in combination.
Follow up. So what's the process that ADA takes in that? And do you produce a findings report? Do you look for what the financial implications could be? You know, help me understand what that looks like for ADA.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Vance. So our process would be similar to what we used on the Red Dog Mine, which is where we permit the road. We get it construction ready. We then, and we'll already be talking with the private entities, you know, with projects that would be served by the road. We would then negotiate with those entities to pay the toll or pay an annual cost that would pay off the bonds for the road. So we would require commitments sufficient to pay ADA's annual bond fees, bond costs per year, and pay off the road. It would look like, eventually, it would look a lot like Red Dog, where our investment in a road and a port is through bonding, but then the bond payments are made by the private sector.
Follow up. So we just had the railroad in, and if, for instance, on the Port Mac Rail, you know, they could come to the legislature and say, hey, we need $50 million to be able to start this. What's your process in that type of partnership?
Sure. So through the chair, Representative Vance, so internally we would get the project ready to go, basically get it permitted, get the arrangements in place with the private sector, and depending on the current status of our bonding authority through the legislature, we would come to the legislature, because it would be over $25 million, we would come to the legislature for approval. We would review the finance plan. I think it's usually LBNA that tends to take the lead in reviewing finance plans and commenting back to the legislature, because some of that work might occur in the off session. But ultimately, we would have a private sector agreement with the private sector that's then reviewed and scrutinized by the legislature before bonding authorities approve.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I asked this question of the railroad in working with the private sector. Mm-hmm. I feel like one of the gaps that we've had in this conversation is that there hasn't really been a visible, there hasn't been a calculation of what's needed from the private sector to see if it's viable. There's interested parties, but they don't know how much it would take. So what action does ADA take when you see a project that would be beneficial to the state, like Fort Mac? Obviously, you're working on the road, but do you say, hey, this is possible, or do you wait till private investors come to you? Or is it that an action that ADA takes specifically?
Sure. So it can work either way. We'll proactively outreach to private sector if we think that's a good thing to do to get things started, or it's more common that they've already come to us, you know, and said, hey, we have this project. All we need is access. Is this something that ADA could do? And then we would commit to pay for it. So either way, whatever it takes to get the ball rolling, so to speak, and the discussion started. And we have started these discussions with the project proponents in this project.
Thank you.
Thank you. So one last follow-up for me, if you don't mind. I'm interested to know, you know, there's a number of other entities out there, PENWAR, in especially that Regional Infrastructure Accelerator Loan Program. And I'm wondering how that fits in. I mean, a lot of this kind of stuff, we're going to have to do public-private partnership, Northern Rail Extension especially. So I'm wondering how a company or an entity like PENWAR and that RIA loan thing could fit in a plan like we're sort of talking around.
Sure. Chair, our goal is always to find the lowest cost financing so it puts the least burden, you know, on the private sector and makes it more likely the project will succeed. And so if what we usually do is we'll go through a process of calculating what our rates and fees would be under our bonding authority. We may look at other options for bonds to be issued. Sometimes a project will fall within a category under the federal code as being tax exempt bonding available. And then we'll look at the federal loan and other loan guarantee programs and see if we can mesh them, you know, create a combination of different things and get the rates even lower. So we're happy to look at PENWAR, any programs out there, and just do a due diligence review and see what fits together, you know, the best.
Thanks. Any other questions? Representative Stutz.
Yes, I do have a question. Within the last month or so, there was an article out with some expenditures that ADA made that were questionable. Can you help us understand that a bit, please?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I think I know which article you're referencing.
I think it was 50, through the chair. I think it was $54 million or somewhere in that vicinity.
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, correct. So there was a, I think, a complaint letter filed by an environmental organization, trustees, or the Wilderness League, who said that ADA isn't allowed to spend or invest in projects without every decision being approved by the legislature. And so we're working on a response to the ombudsman on that issue. We feel our statutory authority is clearly broad enough to allow us to function and engage in our project investment, including our loan program. And so we anticipate basically getting a clean bill of health, so to speak, from the ombudsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would this have anything to do with the $25 million authority, or is that what they're professing possibly? And then in response, maybe you had bonding authority of some sort?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, as I remember the article and the complaint letter, it didn't relate to our bonding authority. It just simply related to our authority in general to invest in projects, which we have, you know, multiple sections of our organic code allows us to do basically anything that is determined to be in the interest of economic development and jobs, subject to, you know, the number of limits that are in place, bonding authority limits and other things. So if it's not those types of things, then we have statutory authority to invest.
Thank you.
Thanks for getting that out there, Representative Stutz. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, thank you, Director Rohrer, for your presentation. I have a question just related to the online checkbook. I know there was an article about it back in December and that different state corporations were in the middle of being integrated in the online checkbook. Is there an update on that?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, we were just discussing this the other day, and what I understand to be the issue is with the IT departments at ADA and the IT department at admin not communicating well together, different operating systems. We're aware of the requirement and we'll be working to get integrated as soon as we can. It may take a substantial investment in IT infrastructure, but we are working on that.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
Through the chair, do you have a timeline? I know it's going to take some time, and there's a couple of more cogs that were thrown in the process.
Through the chair, Representative Mina, I don't have a timeline for you right now. I can check with our IT section and get back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Anybody else? Okay, Mr. Rohrer, you're off the hot seat. Thanks. I'd like to thank you and your team for being here today, and got a little bit astray of infrastructure bonding, but it's all good. We get some things out on the record for folks to further understand ADA and the good work that you do, and I appreciate any help you can give us with Port McKenzie Rail Extension.
Yeah.
Don't forget
the ferries. Did I say that before yet?
Don't forget the ferries.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. We'll, I'll get you the follow-up items that mentioned today.
Okay. Thanks. So next on the agenda is HB 233. We have David Goff, staff to Representative Frank Tomaszewski, to introduce the bill. Representative Tomaszewski is in House Finance Committee this afternoon, so he is unable to join us. I'd like Mr. Goff to introduce the bill. We will forego the sectional and hope we can all have read that on our own. We have a lot of people who flew in for this hearing, so I'd like to be able to fit them in with the time we have. So if that's okay with the committee, Mr. Goff, you please place your name on the record and begin your introduction of the bill.
For the record, David Goff, staff to Representative Frank Tomaszewski, and this is House Bill 233, vehicle warranty work, and our sponsor statement, an act relating to rates and time allowances for motor vehicle warranty work. House Bill 233 makes a key change to the auto warranty statute by adding time allowances to the schedule of compensation for warranty work. Thousands of Alaskans benefit from warranty work every year as part of the agreement with auto manufacturers from whom they've purchased their car. By agreeing to sell cars on behalf of certain manufacturers, auto dealers assume the responsibility of coordinating the time and labor spent performing warranty repair work on their cars. Warranty work differs from regular auto work in that the manufacturer compensates the dealer directly. Additionally, qualified dealers do not have the ability to refuse the work. Auto manufacturers compensate dealers for warranty work using rates and time allowances that dictate the maximum amount of time that the dealer may bill for different repairs. The rates and time allowances that manufacturers use to reimburse dealers for warranty work are often much lower than the rates and time allowances that dealers and independent mechanic bills consumers for non-warranty work. As a result, dealers are often forced to pay their mechanics more than they are compensated by the manufacturer or risk losing their mechanics to independent shops. Across the nation, states have taken varied approaches to addressing how to ensure fair payment for dealers by manufacturers. HB 233 takes an approach used by states like Colorado, Montana, and Illinois by requiring that manufacturers compensate dealers for warranty work at the same rates and time allowances that the dealer charges retail customers for similar non-warranty work. So there's a standard, that's out there, like the Chilton manual, for those of us that grew up in a earlier time when maybe we used a Chilton book to figure out how to repair our vehicles when we bought them, and that regulates the time to protect the customer when he goes in to get warrant or get work done in a shop. It tells the maximum amount of time that it will take to be billed for that work. In this case, the warranty work, the manufacturer sets the time allotment, which is much less time to get that work done, and they cannot get the work done in that time on a regular basis. So we're asking that those times are matched up with those manuals for the dealers as they do the warranty work.
Thanks, Mr. Goff. So any questions from the committee? Come on, you know you have one.
I do. I always do.
Representative Stutes.
I do. I have a question. What prompted this bill?
Through the chair to Representative Stutes, we did a visit to several of the dealerships within Fairbanks, and it's been brought to our attention that this bill was brought forward 6 years ago to the legislature, and it was discussed, and it was referred back to working with the manufacturers and the dealers to try and get something worked out between them. That never worked out. The manufacturers were not willing to negotiate, is our understanding. And so now we're bringing this back to present it before the legislature to see if we can get some resolution here.
Follow up. Thank you. Did the manufacturers and the dealers, in fact, have any communication about negotiating this situation that you're aware of?
I would like to defer to the dealers to answer that.
No problem. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goff, I'm trying to formulate some intelligent questions here. I have friends on both sides of this issue, so I'm really trying to understand what's happening. Are all the car manufacturers in America involved in this in Alaska? All the major ones? Chevy, Ford, Dodge, Kia, Hyundai.
Each of those are represented here.
You're all.
So I believe each of those are here to testify.
So are any of them are any of them matched up, or none of them are matched up on these rates? Am I making sense?
My understanding is no.
Okay, so we've got a unified good guys and bad guys situation, huh?
Yeah.
So if the way I understood this when it was explained to me was if they change out a transmission for a Chevy Silverado under perfect conditions in Detroit, it takes, let's just say, 8 hours.
Through the chair, that's...
But, right. So you, and the Chevy dealer up here, we get paid for the 8 hours. In reality, when I take my Chevy Silverado in Anchorage, let's say, South Anchorage Chevy, and they need to change out the transmission, there's some other things that they need to do before they can actually disconnect the transmission. They got to put it up on the lift. I don't know if they got to take off the tires or, you know, there's other things. There's other peripheral things that have to happen, which might make the job last 10 hours. I'm just trying to use a real hypothetical. So the big debate here is that 2 hour extra. Is that the nut of this whole thing?
Through the chair to Representative McKay, correct. There's
okay.
A difference in the hours that the manufacturer says it will take and what the hours typically take to do the job that they're saying would only take that 8 hours in this case.
There may be a better example, but I'm just trying to. So it's under perfect shop conditions, and then reality can be two different things.
I would like through the chair to Rep. McCabe. I'd like the dealers and the mechanics to answer that question.
Right. Thanks,
and they'll be coming up. There are a number of that will be coming up. For the record, I'm horribly remiss. Representative Sumner joined us at 1:20, and again at 2:05. Somewhere in there, Representative Craig Johnson snuck in as well. So they're both here, Linda. So I appreciate putting them on the record. So I think we'll take a brief at ease and set up for Mr. Nichols from Fairbanks Nissan. He's the president of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, and he will have a little bit of a presentation for us, a few slides. So brief at ease. So we are back on the record. As I said, Mr. Les Nichols from Fairbanks Nissan and president of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. You can place your name on the record in your own voice for us, please, and begin your presentation. And we will kind of pause at every slide and see if there's any questions on the slide. I think you have, half dozen?
We got a couple in there, yes, sir.
Okay, awesome. On we go.
All right. Well, again, my name is Les Nichols, last name N-I-C-H-O-L-S. I'm the president of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, and I'm the owner and operator of Fairbanks Nissan in Fairbanks, Alaska. Appreciate your time today. I know that you guys have had quite a bit going on down here, and this is no small matter to those of us that come down to ask for your assistance. So to start off, the Alaska Auto Dealers Association is a statewide association of auto dealers, both franchise new car dealers and independent used car dealers. We represent our state's auto dealers by promoting best practices, providing communication on the state of the automotive industry in Alaska, and representing dealers' concerns to our elected officials, as we are here today. Just to kind of give you a sense of our side of the industry, in Alaska, we have 27 dealerships. We employ roughly 4,000 people, about 66 people per dealership. We do about $2 billion in sales annually with all the dealerships, and payroll is about $135 million a year. Obviously, state sales tax isn't an issue in this state. So one of the things that I want to start with is why we're talking to you about this. I'm grateful for the resistance of our representatives to get involved in private contracts. I would agree that that is the right thing to do. This is a little bit different, and I'm going to explain why. When the franchise relationships started, manufacturers came to dealers and said, look, we don't have enough money to distribute these cars. It takes a lot to build them. If you would buy the land, build the facilities, we'll sell you the vehicles and the parts, and you guys handle fixing them and selling them and so on and so forth. And early in the relationship, it was pretty level playing field. As the manufacturer's strength grew, those contracts became more and more one-sided. Got to a point where dealers decided, hey, you know what? I think we're going to get together and try and negotiate because as individuals, we have no power. Unfortunately, that looked like a horizontal antitrust issue. And it was taken to court. GM actually was the other side of that. And GM opted to get some language put in there in the ruling that said, look, dealers cannot get together to come negotiate with us. So you got all these dealers trying to have an opinion about how these contracts work, but it possesses antitrust issues. So we got to stop this from happening. And they were successful. And in the language, they said that they wanted the words in there to the effect of, we being two equally capable and sophisticated parties, and you will probably hear that in other testimony from the other side. I'm going to tell you at this point in the history of the manufacturing industry, we're not even close to equally sophisticated and capable parties. So in 1978, the United States Supreme Court recognized the need for motor vehicle dealer franchise laws. Quote, dealers are, with few exceptions, completely dependent on the manufacturers for their supply of cars. When the dealer has invested to the extent required to secure a franchise, he becomes, in a real sense, the economic captive of his manufacturer. The substantial investment of his own personal funds by the dealer in the business, the inability to convert easily the facilities to other uses, meaning once we build a car dealership to look like a Chevy store or a Ford store, they don't become McDonald's later. They're not going to be turned into a Lowe's at some other point. That facility is what that facility is. And the difficulty of obtaining franchises from other manufacturers all contribute toward making the dealer an easy prey for domination by the factory. On the other hand, from the standpoint of the automobile manufacturer, any single dealer is expendable. The faults of the factory dealer system are directly attributable to the superior market position of the manufacturer. So although they like to say that we are equally sophisticated partner, we're not even close. This was also driven home in the 08 crisis. So Ford, Chevy, and Chrysler went to the federal government and said, hey, man, we're in trouble. We need money. And the government came to them with loans in the billion-dollar range. And in that same time frame that they were getting bailed out, they were canceling dealerships. They were taking mom-and-pop operations and say, hey, thanks for being a dealer. You're not anymore. Sorry you lost your life fortune there. You're done. even people that had just signed dealer agreements, built new facilities, and are ready to go, they said, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore. It's over. So on one side, they're squashing the investment of the dealers, while on the other side, they have access to significant bailouts and revenues from the federal government. So when it suits the manufacturers, GM in particular, they have access to these remedies, and they want you to believe that it were equal. And so after telling the federal government, hey, look, these guys shouldn't be allowed to organize and come negotiate with us because of antitrust laws, then they turn around here years later, fly down and tell you guys, hey, you guys shouldn't be involved in this negotiation. This is not like a situation where I come to a builder and said, hey, would you please build me a home? And they give me a price I don't like and I go to somebody else. Or we have a disagreement in the contract and we can negotiate it out. This is not that. When there is a disagreement, there is no resolution other than what they say. One of our members has been a Volvo dealer for the last 25 years and was given a requirement by the Volvo organization to build a facility to sell, you know, a small number of cars every year that didn't substantiate the facility. He said, listen, mathematically, we can't do this. I said, okay, you're no longer a Volvo dealer. Thanks for being with us for 25 years. It's over. So to that end, in 2018, the Alaska legislature found that the distribution of and sale of motor vehicles in the state of Alaska affects the general economy of the state and the interest and welfare of the residents of the state. Number one way for people to get out of poverty is to have transportation. Providing warranty service for new motor vehicles is a matter of substantial concern to the residents of the state. The maintenance and a fair competition among new motor vehicle dealers is in the public interest. Maintaining strong and sound new motor vehicle dealerships in the state is essential to providing the consuming public with continuing and reliable services necessary for their motor vehicle. And this number four is directly being attacked by the way things are right now, and we'll show that here in a minute. Strong and sound new motor vehicle dealerships with active service departments will provide stable employment opportunities for the residents of the state. That's also at risk right now. And the legislature declares that this act is remedial and to the extent permitted by the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the United States Constitution. It is the intent of the legislature that the provisions of this act apply to all franchise law agreements between manufacturers and new motor vehicle dealers. So, again, the ability to negotiate on our own has been taken from us on a federal level and delegated to you at the state level, which is why we have to come to you. And again, appreciate the resistance and reluctance to be involved in a private contract matter, but they can't have it both ways. They can't limit our ability to negotiate at the federal level and then come tell you don't get involved. I guess they can. The question is that fair? So the problem we have right now is manufacturers help themselves to a massive self-decided discount on the time they will pay dealers and subsequently our employees for the warranty repairs. To be clear, they don't pay our employees. We participate in a revenue sharing system. So however many hours a technician works, they get paid for the hours that job bills. And that's where they're taking a chunk out of the time. Automotive News in February 27th of 23, Mr. White previously worked as a field service manager for Ford and stated that the manufacturers aggressively discount labor time estimates. You're going to hear from a Ford Ford dealer's representative today about how they do that and that they do, in fact, discount the times that they publish. Technicians are avoiding working for dealerships because they are paid for more hours for the same work when they work for an independent repair facility. Their discounts shift the expense of warranty repairs from the manufacturer directly to the Alaskan consumers. So,
can we just stop there just a second?
Yes, sir.
So, any questions from anybody else yet? Okay, so under the problem, I think what you're saying, and this will maybe be better understood, is you are having for warranty work to pay the mechanics flat rate. Mm-hmm. And that's all that you can charge back to the manufacturer. So essentially the mechanics suffer.
Yes.
Because it might take them 12 hours or 15 hours, as Representative McKay said, to do a 10-hour job, and they only get paid for 10 hours.
Essentially, and I've got a great slide to kind of break that down and the difference that of that cost to the Alaskan consumer versus the manufacturer.
And that has to do with what Representative McKay said, you got to clean the underneath of the car. You got to pull it in onto the rack. It, you know, put it up on the rack. Take the tires off.
Those can be factors, but there are other factors. I'll give you an example I was going to get to a little bit later, but I think it's pertinent now. So one of the things you're going to hear from the opposition is that they are the only ones that know how long these repairs take. I would argue that the people representing these organizations have no idea how long they take because they're not mechanics. Our mechanics know, they do it every day. Our service managers know because they look at the times and they watch over the mechanics doing the work to make sure that we're being as efficient as possible. And what you're going to find is that there are a lot of cases, unfortunately the majority of the cases, where they say this job can be done in X hours and we don't know anybody can do it in that time frame. They say that their times are scientifically determined. So one of my responses would be, well, I know that the machine that I have to use to evacuate an air conditioning system and recharge it can do that job in about 90 minutes. It is limited by the amount of material it can pull out of the system and how much it can put back in. 90 minutes. Manufacturer doesn't pay us 90 minutes for that job. And that's if I have it already hooked up, ready to go. It's cars in the bay. It's ready. I hook it up and I press the button 90 minutes from that point. They pay a fraction of that. Scientifically, I would like them to explain to me how we get that done in the time that they compensate us for, because that math doesn't work. You'll find examples where they will charge for an operation. I'll use an example of changing a tire. Let's say they give you 15 minutes to change a tire on the left side of a vehicle. Well, magically on the other side, it's supposed to take a third of that. Why is that? Magically, how does that other side of the car become that much faster? Right? So these scientific methods that they won't share with us, the evidence in video of the processes they won't share with us, which you think they would if they were trying to get to an effective and efficient system. It is in our best interest, the customer's best interest, and the manufacturer's best interest. If the jobs can be done that quickly, man, show us how. I would love to be that fast and efficient. It makes everybody's lives easier.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yep. That's okay. Helpful. Thanks. Anybody else? Okay, on we go.
On we go. So here's what's happened. In 2019, J.D. Powers, who's a research group, does a study, and they do this every year. You can look these up. This one's called the Initial Quality Study. So in 2019, if each of these manufacturers produced 100 vehicles, the number to the right of their name is how many problems there were per 100 vehicles. So the best in the business in 2019 was Genesis. For every 100 vehicles, there were 63 problems. For every Jaguar that rolled off the line, there were 130 problems. So the manufacturers know when they build these vehicles that there are problems that have to be addressed. Now, keep in mind, for them to run them back through the manufacturing process is awkward. It's time-consuming, and they have to deal with the contract of unionized labor that they have working for them. Where they don't have that issue is with the dealers. So rather than send them back through, they just send them on. They know the problems are there. In fact, they'll tell us, hey, we're shipping these vehicles. One of our dealers told us this morning that they are receiving 40 vehicles from the manufacturers. They're on the truck on the way there. They've paid for them. But the manufacturers said, oh, by the way, there's a known issue on these things that makes them unsafe to drive. We don't have a fix for it. You're going to have to sit on them until probably August. By the time they get to sell those vehicles, they will lose on every single one of them. And they're just going to eat the holding cost, but they get to pay a discounted rate to fix it. So they're going to fix it. Manufacturer's not going to pay them the full time. They're going to pay them their scientific time that they have determined. So here it was in 2019, and this is shortly after our last bit of franchise legislation. Here we are in 2023. Dodge is the number one manufacturer in the country in terms of least problems per vehicles. So when Dodge makes 100 vehicles, they have 140 problems. 1.4 problems per Dodge produced. The electric vehicles are bringing on a whole nother layer. Polestar was found to have 313 problems per 100 vehicles produced. Tesla not far behind with 257. On the naturally aspirated or combined hybrid and EV mix, Volvo there is at 250 problems per 100 vehicles produced. So from 2019 to 2023, the amount of problems that the manufacturers are shipping out to the dealers has doubled to tripled. So, sorry, question?
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, real briefly, what are the different colors on the grass?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you that the gray in the middle is the average of the industry, right? The gray at the bottom, I'm not sure why that was done that way. So as you can see, what they're saying is, hey, you know, there's a steady stream of warranty work. And there sure is. So here's the breakdown on how that affects us. You got two columns. One is an Alaskan customer that's not covered by warranty. The other one is a manufacturer warranty pay. So customer brings the car in, it's under warranty. Let's assume the same vehicle. This is a 2020 Ram 1500 engine replacement. So in this scenario, the cost per hour for labor is $190. And if an Alaskan comes in for that job, the independent time guides say it's going to take 29 hours. I'm going to have you guys hear from a technician that's going to tell you that that's pretty close in his years of experience and how much time it takes him to get that job done. Manufacturers are willing to pay nine. So the technician in question here is one of the best technicians I know. And if he can't get it done in that 9 hours, we're all dying to see the Superman technician that manufacturers have stored away that can do this job in 9 hours. So here's the cost. So you take that $190, you multiply it by 29. The labor on that job to someone out of warranty is $5,510. That's what the Alaskans pay. The manufacturer is going to pay $1,700 because they're only paying $190 for 9 hours. It doesn't matter how long it takes the technician to do it. Those are the hours that are billed, right? This is a protection to the consumer, these time guides, because you don't want to come in and say, hey, man, I just got started on this. I have no idea what I'm doing. This is probably going to take me 3 weeks to do, and I'm going to charge you the same hourly rate. That's astronomical for horrible work, right? As opposed to somebody who is an expert in the field and get it done maybe a little bit faster because they've been doing it 20, 30 years. They shouldn't only get paid for, you know, a couple hours because they're really efficient, right? And this is pretty normal through other industries. So again, the Alaskan consumer pays the same dollar per hour that the manufacturers pay. That was established in the last franchise law revision. They get the same discount. The cost to the Alaskans is $5,500. Manufacturers, $1,700. Now, here's the problem. The manufacturers aren't paying very much. So what happens is, in order to try and make ends meet in our shops, we have to escalate the dollars per hour that we charge the Alaskan consumer. Now, that in turn escalates what we charge them per hour, but they're only paying a fraction of the hours. Does that make sense? Because I think this is where a lot of people struggle. They say, well, the cost per hour is the same. Yeah, but one's going to be $1,700 and one's going to be $5,500. So here's what happens on the other side. After you take out the technician's pay, the one that did the work, and we're using $50 an hour on this one. We're going to assume a master technician with lots of experience, so they're really fast. On that customer pay job for an Alaskan, they're going to make $1,450 on not quite a week's worth of work. The manufacturer, they're going to make $450. They're going to make $1,000 less for doing it for the manufacturer. The manufacturers love this number. You're going to hear it a lot. Dealers make 74% gross profit. Don't ask them about net profit. It doesn't fit their narrative. What that means is after I charge my $190 for an hour and I pay that technician for an hour, I've got 74% left over. What do I do with that? Well, we have to pay our service writers. We have to pay our service managers. We have to pay our lot porters. We have to pay a warranty administrator who helps get us paid, because if we don't follow their 320-page manual, they will take the money back from us and we make nothing. Just paying the service department, that's going to bring, on that first equation, $2,500 left over, but the manufacturer leaves me $314. That's not quite the net. So in the first example, the employees in total make about 53% of that job. The employees make 82% of the job done for the manufacturer. That leaves us 18% on a warranty job to pay for technical training, special tools, image compliance, warranty chargebacks, because they will come and take the money back. Rent, electric, gas, water, sewer, advertising, health insurance, and go down the list. Every time we do a job like this for the manufacturer, we lose. And I want to make that real evident here. So if I were to take, and they will say, it's your job to pay the technician. We share the revenue. So if I paid the technician $1,450 for the warranty pay job, I'm only left with $300 by the time I get done paying the service employees now. I will be $700 in the hole before I pay my people out of service. But don't worry, there's a steady stream of this work and they're going to give it all to us. You understand the problem, I think. So who's affected? They take these discounts out of the hands of Alaskan employees. Alaskan businesses and the Alaskan economy to unfairly pad their bottom line. Technicians are unable to bill full hours for their work, resulting in lower pay for them and their support staff, including the service writers and service managers. They're all taking a portion of this revenue. There are hourly cases, there are salary cases. Those are very few in the industry. Most of this is based on a revenue sharing model. Alaskan businesses are affected. Fairbanks has lost as a result of being unable to make ends meet. We have lost Buick, Cadillac, Daewoo, Hyundai, Kia. I said twice, I was mistaken. Kia has failed three times in Fairbanks. Mazda, Mercedes, and Volkswagen. Juneau has lost Chevy once, Ford and Mazda and Volkswagen. Ketchikan has lost Subaru, Ford, and Chevrolet. Kenai has lost Chevrolet. Kodiak has lost Ford. Anchorage has lost Mitsubishi and Volvo just here recently. There's a lot of times when these dealerships start to fail and they sell off to somebody else in the hopes that they will be able to make those ends meet. And what that leads to is a consolidation of dealerships out of the hands of Alaskan owners and into dealer groups, right? There's only five Alaskan-owned dealerships, new car dealerships left in the state. So that means that those investments and all that stuff is gone. So let's say that in Fairbanks, you bought a Volkswagen from the Volkswagen dealer, and then they went under. Where do you go for service? You're coming to Anchorage. You got to get that vehicle. You're shipping it. There's a lot of expenses there and hardship that goes on those families that have trusted in those brands. So the failure of these brands affects us all very deeply.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, I know when we've had discussions about this, you spoke to how technicians and operators, they move to independent facilities. So a percentage of these employees are moving to those independent facilities versus moving out of state. What happens when these dealers close?
So there's some data there that I don't have, but I can tell you that, let's say, for example, pick a store in our state. If one store shut down and all of those guys were suddenly unemployed, they would all be employed tomorrow. Every dealer in the state is dying for technicians. And this has created a problem that, again, benefits the manufacturer, and I'll kind of illustrate that. So if this business closes and the technician's going, man, what do I do? These guys behind me, a lot of them are my competitors. They will be knocking on those doors, blowing up those phones, saying, we will come move your box. Here's a signing bonus. Come on down. Life is good. Let's get after it. They are happy to soak those guys up. Additionally, the oil industry wants them. The mining industry wants them. Mechanics are in high demand.
DOT wants them.
DOT wants them, absolutely. Absolutely. And they pay very well. We'll have organizations from those industries call and say, hey, I got a problem with my car. Can I talk to your tech for a second? Hey, I got a problem with my car, and I'll pay you double to come work on it. Right? And they will empty out shops. It's hard. So the benefit to the manufacturer in this lack of competition on the warranty work, because they're going, I hate doing warranty work because I don't get paid enough for it. I'd get paid if I went over there. Why am I donating to the manufacturers who are making billions of dollars of profit every year? Why is my family receiving less as a result? So they do, they leave. The stats differ. Some of us elect to pay very, very well. Some of us try to pay very competitively, trying to make some sort of mix to make sure that we're hanging on to these guys, and it's tough. So we end up accepting that we're going to lose in these service operations in the hopes that we can continue to be a dealer and squeak out below grocery store margins as a return. So they're relatively safe in their ability to transfer, but that's the problem. So the manufacturer is an example. I currently have four fleets of a competitor's product that come to me for service. Now, why in the world would they come to my store for service? The issue is when they go in and say, I have an engine problem. My truck that I use for work is no longer usable. I need to get it fixed. And my competitor says, we don't have enough technicians for the workload. I can see you in 6 months. That's not an exaggeration. Okay, take the case of a single mother who's going, I need my car fixed. Check engine lights on. It's not drivable. 6 months, we'll get you in. Now, if you're in the case of the single mother, you have to go rent a car. Manufacturer will pay $35, $45 a day for 5 days. After that, you're on your own for the rest of the 6 months, unless they're feeling benevolent at that time. So if you can imagine what $50 to $100 a day rental car operation costs weigh on a family, they don't have that. It's a huge hardship. So then they say, will you fix my car at another store? And I say, yeah, we can do it, but we're going to charge. I'll pay it because, you know, in a month's worth of rental fees, I'm going to lose that money anyway. So they come in, we fix it. I'm not a certified repair facility for that brand, so I charge. But now they have the potential that that warranty has been voided. So the manufacturer never has to pay that claim, right? And they potentially can say, you know, the rest of the warranty is void too because you didn't have it done by one of our facilities. So not only do they not pay as many hours, but it offsets those repairs that they're responsible for to suffering families and businesses. And then that potentially alleviates them of any future warranty responsibility, right? This is dangerous. Alaskan consumers, again, as we discussed, if they're taking a big chunk, the only place that we have to affect how much money we make is to increase the cost per hour, right? And the people that bear that the most are our local family members, community members, sorry. So the solution is that this bill would require manufacturers to pay the same number of hours for repair that a customer would be charged for non-warranty work. Basically, we're saying whatever guide we use, we're not endorsing a guide. We're saying whatever independent guide we use, and that's what we use to charge our Alaskan customers, that's the number of hours that you're going to pay. This alleviates ideas of like collusion or fixing because there are multiple guides out there, right? We're not all saying we're going to use the same one. We're not. So we get to make that determination based on what we feel is competitive. And we are competitors. There's no doubt about it. I'm here to take all the business I can from everybody that sits behind me, right? And the relationship is mutual this way. So, but what we want is the manufacturers to pay the same time that we would charge an Alaskan, because they will tell you they're our number one customer. They are absolutely not. Alaskans are our number one customer every single day. They buy the cars. They own the cars. They're responsible for getting them fixed. That's who our primary concern is for. So this bill would provide protections to Alaskans by requiring them to pay equal compensation for the warranty work that we do versus non-warranty customer work. It creates a level playing field for the Alaskan consumer by preventing the manufacturer from inflating the cost of repairs on consumers by discounting the time. Another thing that they're going to like to tell you is that there's no guarantee that the money that they pay us in addition on this, let's just assume that they don't like it and they think it's unfair. And if they give us the money, that me as a dealer, I'm just going to keep it all, right? I will have a walkout in my store tomorrow if I told them, hey, we can now bill the same hours for this job as this job, but I'm not going to pay you for them. My text would be gone in 24 hours. So this idea, bring that up to the technicians that are here today, please. You're going to find that that's absolutely a pipe dream. Manufacturers believe that they deserve a discount for volume work. We've covered that. And it doesn't matter. They have sophisticated methods to extract discounts. They're going to tell you, too, that this will drive up prices on consumers. I'm going to tell you now that's not happening from our side as a dealer. That's going to happen on their side, and we've seen how they do that. What they do is they retaliate against states that implement these laws by introducing surcharges on the vehicles. So they say, okay, Alaska changed the law, so we're going to introduce a surcharge on every single vehicle. It's a punishment, and they are very punitive in their systems. For example, one of the things I'm sure you'll hear is that they have systems for us to request extra time. Those are traps. So GM in particular in previous hearings said that they approved 97% of all requests for additional time. So what they didn't get real clear about is they only got 2% of the ROs looked at in the state of Alaska. Only 2% of them were submitted for additional time. So you got a rusted bolt that won't come out, it breaks, something like that. So out of that 2% of repair orders that were submitted for additional time, they approved 97% of the 2% of total ROs. The reason is that their system for getting that time is onerous. So every time a tech checks into the job for that extra time, okay, I'm checking in to do this thing that I asked for more time for. Okay, now I got to check out of it and document it. Okay, now I got to go check back in for the next step. And okay, I got to check out, go document it. This back and forth eats the time that they asked for. They didn't get anything. They just wasted their time in documentation, right? So it discourages dealers from asking for any additional time. Additionally, as one of our GM members testified to the previous committee, the GM has a threshold, and it's not unique to them. If you request more hours than this line, you trigger a warranty audit. They're going to come in and see if you've done all your documentation correct, These audits are an extraction method. So they don't share what that level is. How many can I request? Not going to tell you. We're just going to tell you when you're over it and we'll come and take your money, right? The last audit, he disclosed that they took $50,000 out of his open account. And these are for almost always in the cases that we've seen here are for clerical errors. Service manager didn't initial line on an RO. They forgot to document a particular bolt on one step of the operation. And they don't discount that bolt. They discount the entire operation, the parts, the labor, all of it. So imagine you do a $20,000 repair to a vehicle, but you forgot to put a signature on a particular line, that you didn't comply with one item in a 320-page manual of compliance. They take it all back, right? So these we can apply for extra time. They're punitive in nature. They are risky, which is why they're not used frequently. So they're going to claim that this is a money grab by dealers. When we try and level a playing field, but it's not a money grab when they take it as a discount, I'm struggling with that. So when the water flows their direction, it's good. But when the water flows to the direction of Alaskan businesses, Alaskan employees, and Alaskan families, and Alaskan economy, it's bad. It's a money grab. I you know, it's just who's on the which side of it. And my argument is that we should be paid fairly for the work that we do. That's fair. Manufacturers know that the contracts they offer are of adhesion, and we're of such disproportionate bargaining power that there's nothing they can do. Again, they showed that in 2008 when they administered letters to dealers and just said, you're no longer a dealer. A friend of mine in Miami had that problem. The manufacturer came in and said, hey, man, things are tough. Sorry, thanks for being a dealer. You're done. I know it's a generational thing. You can get out. Yeah, they took back his property because they had it financed. They didn't give him a chance to sell it, do anything else. They just took the property and moved on. And he lost everything that day. So that's how heavy-handed these things are, and again, why we need your help. They can only be provided by state law. The simple fact is that auto manufacturers retain to this day a massive economic advantage over their franchise dealers, resulting from market structure, manufacturer behavior, and intrusion into the market by a federal antitrust statute. And manufacturers often use this excess power and overreach and act opportunistically in their relationships with their dealers to the detriment to the dealers and ultimately to the consumers. The state franchise laws that have been enacted to counteract these anomalies and to afford the dealers reasonable opportunity to negotiate their economic relationships. I would like to say that this makes a big difference to us in a time of massive inflation. When I bought my dealership, our labor hour was, in 2014, it was $95 an hour, something like that. This year, we had to raise that to $225 an hour. I shake my head at it, but that's still not leveling the balance sheet at the end of it. It's scary. So just a couple other quick notes. I really want you to consider the terms when they talk about you've got no business being involved in this. If you could give us the rights back to get together like a union and negotiate, we're happy to do so. We feel like we're decent negotiators. But if you can't do that, that power is stripped from us. You're all we've got. And if you don't do this, then what we said essentially is that the manufacturer's interest and ability to extract these discounts and create this disparity in competition between independents and franchise dealers makes more sense than the well-being and the economic stability of a fair system. Your constituents are behind me waiting to talk, so with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
Okay, thanks. Very briefly, because we have about 8 invited testifiers back here, and I'd like to get through all of them, but if you can wait, then okay. Anybody else? Mr. Nichols, thanks. I appreciate it. So let's move on to additional invited testimony we have with us today. I'm going to take this testimony in a way that I think is fair to all the dealerships, so I know that some of you have multiple people per dealership. So what I'd like to do is get through all the dealerships, one person from each dealership first, and then if we have enough time, we'll get to the others. And I don't know how we picked them, but somebody picked them. I think maybe my staff flipped a coin or something. But so the first person up, door number one, Susan Hicks, service manager, Fairbanks Chrysler. please come to the table and provide your testimony. And keep in mind that I'd like to keep it brief so I can get everybody in.
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Susan Hicks. I'm the service director at Jeans Chrysler in Fairbanks. I'd like to take time to say thank you for hearing my testimony for HB 2233. As you consider this bill, I'd like to make a few points. Warranty repair times, manufacturer's warranty repair times are not based on real-world scenarios. According to an article by Auto Data Publication, manufacturers conduct several timed tests for a predetermined repair and average that labor time. For these studies, manufacturers use a new vehicle with all required tools laid out. The vehicle is already on the hoist. This type of study does not represent real-world scenarios, especially in Alaska. Rear-world means pulling or towing a frozen vehicle into the shop, waiting for it to warm up enough to be worked on, then performing diagnostics to determine what repair is needed and repairing the vehicle. Passage of this bill would bridge the gap between the manufacturer's allowed times and the time that it actually takes to repair a vehicle. The discrepancy between warranty labor times and retail labor time negatively impact the dealer's ability to attract and maintain skilled technicians. Since 2016, my dealership has lost a combined total of 104 years in technician experience because they could not make a living performing warranty work in Alaska. According to the dealership workforce study published by NADA in 2022, the annualized turnover rate for dealership technicians is 30%. Passage of this bill would make Alaska dealers more competitive. In previous testimony, factory representatives stated that factory-trained technicians can meet published warranty times at a rate of 50%. That means 50% of the time a technician is working for free. Could you and your family survive if you worked an eight-hour day and only got paid for four? Dealers have asked manufacturers to share their time studies so that we can learn how to meet or beat the posted warranty times, and to date, no manufacturer will share that information. So I must ask you, if posted warranty times are accurate, then why will manufacturers not share these time studies so that field technicians can become more efficient? Passage of this bill is could be a substantial economic impact for Alaska. In a recent study by the Illinois Economic Policy Institute, the state of Illinois, who passed similar legislation in 2021, data showed employee turnover rate was reduced by 9%. Hours worked per week went up approximately 6%, and the Illinois state economy was boosted by approximately $302 million. Now, obviously, those numbers are going to be different for Alaska, but the Illinois study demonstrates there's simply no downside to Alaskans for passing this bill. Manufacturers have implied that if this bill passes, a technician will not see any pay increase. That's patently false. The number of hours a job pays impacts on how much a technician is paid. Under the current model, if a warranty job pays 9 hours, the tech is paid 9 hours. His or her hourly rate is 9 hours, at 9 hours. Now imagine if a tech is paid, let's say $35 an hour, 9 hours at his or her hourly rate, that would be $315. Now if that same job paid 29 hours at his or her hourly rate of $35 an hour, the technician would be paid $1,015. That's a substantial pay increase for the technician. And do you honestly believe the technician sitting behind me would be here testifying in favor of this bill if it weren't going to positively impact their wages?
I'm going to have to wrap you up there, Ms. Okay. Hicks.
Thank you so much.
Finish your sentence or whatever.
No, okay. We're good. Thank you.
Thanks. And what I think I'm going to do, just to make it fair for everybody, is I'm going to have Angie set a timer for 2 minutes for us. And, you know, if you're finishing a thought or something, then we'll let you go a little bit longer. So
thank
next we have
time.
Josh Geyer. Is that how you say that? G-E-I-E-R?
Yep.
Service Manager of Seekins Ford. Please come forward and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Representative. For the record, I am Josh Geyer, Service Manager at Seekins Ford. Been doing this for 20 years. The big discrepancy with these scientifically studied labor time guides that the dealerships, that the manufacturers produce is, I have a case in point of a vehicle that pays 1.4 hours to do a repair. By their studies, recently they've come out with a recall from their failures down at the factory and everything else. That recall for the exact same repair, now only pays 1 hour. So why are we getting a sudden cut from your standard warranty time now down to your recall time? Now when we look at the third party, the standard labor time guides of our independent repair facilities, that repair pays 2.1 hours. My technician sitting here behind me, we're lucky to be able to crank that job out in about an hour and a half. And that's him if he has all his parts, tools ready to go when he starts the job. Real world idea is we have to tow the vehicle in, drive it in, get it on the hoist, pull tires, collect parts from our parts department and everything else. It is not feasible to do that job from start to finish in an hour, because that is all reimbursable time from when the customer shows up at our dealership, walks in the door, checks in with my service service rider, gets the ticket written up to get identified what his current problem is, to us getting it moved around back to getting moved into the shop. We're only being reimbursed an hour rate from service rider, porter, getting it into the shop, getting the repair done, pulling parts, getting the vehicle out for a final test drive. An hour from something that used to be 1.4 hours by their big study. And again, this is where the standard times that we're looking at pushing for is more realistic. 2.1 hours is a realistic time frame because we are paying, that's roughly 9 people to take care of that one customer job. So.
Okay, thank you. Right on time.
Thank you very much.
All right, next we have Eric Connick. Connick, I'm sorry, from Lithia Kia in Anchorage. Oh, the Big Laker.
I am a Big Laker.
All right. I like you already.
Thanks for I like you too, McCabe. Appreciate it. Am I ready to go?
Yep. Just place your name on the record.
Thanks for having me. My name's Eric Connick, lifelong Alaskan. Been here my whole life. Never been to Juneau. Probably the best capital in the United States, I would guess. Had a great time. So, again, real quick, I know I got 2 minutes. You know, I got a phone call. I know this bill has been in motion for a little bit, and Lithia as an auto group hasn't been down here. And so they called me a couple days ago and said, hey, let's go help support this. And I hear one of my mentors kind of on my shoulder going, you're not in it for the money. You're in it for your team. And that's why I'm here. I'm here for my guys. I'm here for my technicians. I'm here for Tony Egbert, who gets up every day and drives in from Wasilla and leaves his house at 5:30 and opens my store at 7. And every day he deals with warranty and labor rate times. And every day we struggle to keep technicians in our facility. Every week I deal with, hey, why are you working there for that manufacturer when you could go work in this sector, make just as many, make more hours and have a better living? So every day we deal with this. And I think one thing that I want to say is I was reading a letter from Kia, and I like my manufacturer, but they made a couple points. And one of the points that really perturbed me was the only people that will benefit from this bill is the dealers, is us, as like a business. And I just want to reiterate to you that the more technicians that I hire, the more good people that we can have and the more Alaskans that we can employ and keep in our facilities, absolutely the better experience every consumer that buys a new car or a pre-owned car under warranty in this state is going to have a way better experience and allow me to staff my store. So I think the biggest issue for me, Mr. Chair, and the rest of you here on the committee, and a lot of us back here, is simply the retaining of technicians, number one. And number two, I'll give you one last example. If you buy a 2020 Kia Sorento from me and it's under warranty, Kia pays me 5 hours to change that motor. I mean, that means you pull it in at 7 and by noon, and I have proof of that. So you think about that. I could barely change a tire in an hour, yet alone have a technician with the confidence, if you bring your car in, not only change the motor, but the confidence that that technician did that job in his ability. And he knows that if he missed that bolt, my job might be on the line, right? And so, I appreciate your time. We need your help. I want to grow up on Burma when I retire, and maybe I'll see you there. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mr. Connick. So I skipped Mr. Richard Swenson, Fixed Operations Manager of Continental Auto Group.
I'm going to defer my time to Jerry Hedstrom from our store.
Sure.
Who's had a little more important testimony.
Okay. Jerry, step on up and take it away. Just put your name on the record and begin.
Okay. My name is Jerry Hedstrom. I've been working at Continental Honda and Acura as a technician for 23 years now. In that time, I found that trying to meet or make the labor times set by the manufacturer for warranty work has just not been obtainable. Some examples for you real quick, like a 2010 to 13 MDX or ZDX had issues with oil consumption. The fix was to replace all the pistons and piston rings. That's complete engine disassembly, reassembly. So they're willing to pay me 13.1 hours. That's 13 hours and 6 minutes. If you go by the retail labor guide, they'll pay me 22 hours, 22.3 to be precise. That's over a 9-hour difference. I've done that job probably 15 times, and I haven't been able to come close to that 13 hours. So another example, too, is the manufacturer will take their warranty times, and they'll lower them for known problems. So 2016 to 2026, known issue with the air conditioning compressor leaking out of the front seal. They extended the warranty 10 years, unlimited miles. So some of these cars are rusted, beat up, and I still have to try and get this compressor pulled out. Well, normal fix is just to replace the compressor. Now they want us to actually rebuild them. So I have to take the front end of that compressor apart, use special tools to replace that front shaft seal, then put it back together and get it back in the car, evacuate and recharge it. Well, to just replace that compressor under warranty, they'd pay me 2.1 hours. That's what they pay me to rebuild it, is 2.1 hours. They will give me no additional time to rebuild the front end of that compressor. If you go by the retail labor guide, they'll pay me 4.5 hours just to replace the compressor. Something else that Honda recently came down with is they are no longer going to pay for normal diagnosis time. It's right here in writing. So what that means is if a car comes in with a check engine light on, let's say it's a P0497 code, evaporative emissions, low purge flow, I now have to run what's called a function test for that using the diagnostic tablet. It says specifically on there, it can take up to 15 minutes to run the test. Then it'll give me 3 or 4 possible failures. I have to then physically test, inspect those components. I then figure out which the most common issue is a purge control solenoid valve is bad. So I replace that valve. I now have to run that function test again, up to 15 minutes. Now I have to do the multi-point inspection required by Honda, full inspection top to bottom of the car. They'll pay me 2/10. That's 12 minutes to do that job. It's unreasonable. You can't make that time. And so all we're really asking for with this bill is to just get paid a fair labor time. And those retail labor guides are fair times. And I know I'll try and read this really quick, but there's been questions brought up and how those retail labor times are acquired. So I found this from Auto Data Publications, and I'll just read it real quick. In a nutshell, manufacturer-provided labor times are based on ideal conditions that are not reflective of the typical repair scenario in an auto repair shop. To fix this, aftermarket repair information providers may adjust the manufacturer's times to better reflect reality. At Auto Data Publications, for example, manufacturers' labor times may be increased depending upon the job's level of complexity. The more complex the job, the more time is added. All labor times are increased a small amount simply to account for the upfront administrative work, such as writing up the repair order, bringing the car into the bay, and getting it on the hoist. Simple repairs that normally require few special tools or experience receive no additional labor time adjustment. So these retail labor guides do try and be extremely fair with the times that they quote. And so that's all we're asking for, is to get paid a fair time for each job that we do under warranty for the manufacturer. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thanks, Mr. Headstone. I appreciate that. Next, we're going to go to Todd Novak, Service Director of Anchorage Chrysler. Please come on up and begin your testimony, and you will likely be the last one, unless you're really quick.
I'll try to be quick. For the record, my name is Todd Novak. I'm Parts and Service Director for Anchorage Chrysler. Thank you for taking time to hear us talk about these issues. In short, there's a tech supply deficit in Alaska that's significant, right? We can't find techs. People calling in, Alaska customers trying to get an appointment to get their car fixed, are having to wait weeks, sometimes months, to be able to get in because we don't have enough techs. one of the biggest challenges we find with finding techs and retaining techs. The job has gotten a lot harder. Cars are more advanced. They're very more sophisticated than they were 10 years ago. And the manufacturer's times are one of the biggest, I guess, deterrents from kids getting into the industry. When I'm the chair of the University of Alaska Technical Training Program, so I meet with all the students that come into that program and have an opportunity to talk to them about where they want to take their careers, what kind of things they want to do, how and why they got into the industry. Almost across the board, none of them want to work for manufacturers because of the warranty times. This bill would eliminate that barrier, right? If they knew that they could get paid the same working at a dealership, that they could get paid working at an independent, it completely removes that barrier. They want the technical training that dealerships offer. They want the technical training that they can get from a manufacturer that they can't get in the independent. They just don't want to take the pay cut or that adversity of trying to make a living working on warranty repairs. This bill eliminates that challenge. This bill will help us have more technicians at the dealership to repair customers' cars so that when a new car owner has a problem, they're not in a bad situation, as Les described, having to pay for rentals or pay an independent dealer out of pocket because they can't get warranty work performed. So I thank you for your time. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Novak. So Representative Vance has one question, and then I think Representative Mina, did you still have a question? Okay, so, and then we got to kind of give the room up, but I'm sure that we will be available for you folks afterwards. It better be really quick.
It's really quick. Okay.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chairman. I believe this is for the bill sponsor to work out, you know, with all of the representatives here. I was taking a look at the other state, some of the bills that the other states have passed. Could you provide us, you know, data, because it's been a couple years since they adopted it, of any changes in the prices, if there's been any dealer, not any dealer, manufacturer markup on those vehicles, and if the dealerships have seen an increase in being able to retain technicians, things like that. What I'm looking for, whatever you can find to show, hey, this is working, we like it, hasn't had a detrimental impact on the people of the state, you know, the economics of it, because I want to know what the cause and effect will be of these and making sure that if we do consider passing something, because I'm really, really do not want to get in the middle of contracts. But you've made a compelling argument. But I want to see, is what these other states are doing working, and is the language right? Because this seems like a really big deal with very loose language. So whatever you can provide back to us based on what these other states have done would be helpful information.
Okay. We do have a little bit of time, seeing as how the next committee in here is Labor and Commerce, and they don't really have anything to do because the chairman's sitting right here. So if anybody had any follow-ups or something like that, we have a few minutes. So I could also call some of the other folks, Mr. Swenson, or if you had something compelling, different. Okay. Good. You can ask your question.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard all this about the manufacturers. Is it true that the manufacturers also require certain requirements of the actual building or the premise that the...
Yes, absolutely.
Because it seemed to me you mentioned that the Kodiak automobile, the Ford dealer closed. And I think a big contribution to that was the manufacturer was requiring them to remodel the whole place. And they just determined that they couldn't do that. And so they lost the right to sell the Fords because they refused to. Does that sound right? Do I have that right?
So I guess I'm supposed to state my name again, Les Nichols, Alaska Auto Dealers Association. So yes, that's 100% correct. That is often a contributing factor. That was the case also with Volvo in Anchorage, Continental Volvo. They were being required to build an entirely new facility, and they said, if you don't do this, we're done. And so I can't speak to the case in Kodiak. However, it is a common thing. They will come in and say, I'll give you an example. My manufacturer at one point, we were a commercial dealer for their commercial lines, and they wanted me to pay $30,000 to paint special parking stripes on the ground. I didn't know if they were going to glow through the snow or be visible through the, you know, foot of hard pack that accumulates. But $30,000, and that was for, I want to say, three, maybe four parking spaces, if you can imagine going to a grocery store seeing those lines. So they'll come up with these requirements, and as you can tell by the price tag, a lot of that stuff is often not explainable. It's true with all of them, and some manufacturers are easier to deal with than others, but yes, absolutely, that's correct.
Thanks. Representative Sumner, you had a question, or were you just going to tell me that there is no labor or commerce? Okay. I already got that note. Sorry. They schedule these rooms sometimes so tightly that the chairman do this sometimes, so I wouldn't want to make Sumner mad. So I appreciate you guys all being here, and I appreciate a clear definition of the problem on the record so Alaskans can see. We have gotten, all of us have gotten a number of emails from folks concerned about this. I don't know where they're coming from, probably the dealers or something somehow coming up. But and I thought that you guys needed to be on the record. So I specifically asked for this bill to be heard in transportation simply so we could get it on the record. We are going to hold this and hear it on Saturday again. Sorry, Dave. But we will have public testimony on Saturday where people can call in and give their ideas and their opinions. And maybe we will, I'm sure the manufacturers will probably call in, but that's okay. We get both sides of the story on the record and people can watch these hearings and decide for themselves. So any additional questions from those committee members that are left? All right, seeing no other questions, I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to be here. I'll set this bill aside. An amendment deadline for Friday, April 26th at 12 noon. As I said, our next meeting, Saturday, April 27th, when we will hear SB 127, sponsored by Senator Klayman, as well as HB 233. We'll take public testimony on both bills. Our meeting will begin at 1 o'clock here in room 124. So, seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:06 p.m.